Politics, economics, and environmentalism have collided in Greenland's snap election. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. A vote tally this morning shows Greenland's main opposition party has secured more than a third of the vote. That makes it the biggest party in Parliament, and it's a change that comes with potentially significant implications for the mining industry. The nation's two main political parties have been deeply divided over whether to grant a license to an Australian company with Chinese backing that wants to mine uranium and other rare earth metals there. Some argue rare earth mining could give the world's largest island an economic windfall, while others worry it could hurt its pristine environment. Bjor Poppel, a researcher at the University of Greenland, explains what these election results mean for the future of mining.
The biggest issue in election campaigns, the so-called Gunnersuit project in southern Greenland containing both rare elements and uranium, was sort of the trigger. I think the other projects, as long as they don't contain uranium as a product, will have a way through. The problem, of course, is that when the new government says that projects containing uranium as a result will not be allowed, I think at the same time it's a matter of creating framework and telling the mining industry.
Okay, so it's really uranium is at the heart of the concern.
It's an attitude towards mining as well as other projects that we want them to be environmentally friendly and to contribute to sustainable societies, both locally and in Greenland as such.
So how much untapped mining potential is there in Greenland?
I guess it's fair to say that there's a huge potential of mining. The challenge, of course, is that infrastructure is not that well developed. Also that many places in Greenland where mining would be feasible would be far away from towns. So there'll be both logistical challenge and then a challenge that you should develop a lot of infrastructure. But we have a few mining projects in Greenland going on, and there are a lot of others. And if you look at a map with mineral deposits in Greenland, you'll see that there's not many minerals that we don't have. And actually, a mining project in southern Greenland, very close to the one that was sort of the trigger in the latest election campaign, also contains rare earth elements and without uranium as a byproduct. And that is going on and is in a process.
So Greenland is an autonomous Danish territory, but it still is closely linked economically, and it receives about $600 million a year in subsidies. So it was rare earths mining that was seen as sort of one way of giving the island more financial independence. Without it, or without a big portion of it, what other ways do you think the country could look to diversify its economy?
Well, first of all, I think that most, if not all, of the parties agree that independence is where Greenland is heading, and at the same time, that it's not a matter of a quick fix. It's something that has to be developed over the years. And as you rightly point out, block grants is a large portion of money, and Greenland is dependent on having this for welfare. And then the discussion is also, how can we, as you mentioned, diversify the economy? And one way of doing that would be to both increase fishing, the diversity of fishing, and also the development of the fishing products that we sell. And we then can compare to Iceland, who has a very diversified fishing industry, whereas most of the fish that we export from Greenland is without value added to it. It's more or less the frozen fish or the frozen shrimps. Tourism has been the third piece that has been mentioned as important, and it has over the years been thought that we would be able to make not mass tourism because of a vulnerable environment, but tourism that took care of the environment. But then, of course, as you know, the corona pandemic sets limits to the development, at least for some years, of tourism.
There's so many potential implications from these elections. Bjor Poppel, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Checking the numbers now, key stock benchmarks across Europe and Asia are little changed this morning, but there are a few individual movers. Shares of Japanese conglomerate Toshiba surged more than 18% today. That's after a British private equity group made an offer to buy the company in a $20 billion deal. Here in the UK, shares of delivery giant Deliveroo were up nearly 3%. London Stock Exchange rules had stopped small investors who bought shares during the initial public offering last week from trading them until today. The company's overall stock price is still down about 25% from its debut. A new British regulator that's been described as unashamedly pro-competition has the likes of Google, Facebook, and Amazon squarely in its crosshairs. The Digital Markets Unit will start work today with the goal of curbing tech titan dominance. The BBC's Rory Ketlin-Jones has more on that.
Between them, Facebook, Google, and Amazon control the lion's share of digital advertising revenue. And that kind of dominance has set governments around the world thinking about how to rein in them and the other tech giants. In the UK, that job has been given to the Digital Markets Unit, starting work today inside the Competition and Markets Authority. Its first job will be to think about codes of conduct to govern the relationships between these powerful platforms and their users, whether that's small businesses wanting to advertise or news organisations looking to distribute their journalism. But before taking action against the tech giants, the new regulator will have to wait for such codes to be put into law.
That's Rory Ketlin-Jones reporting there. Well, designer watches have taken a hit during the pandemic. Less reason, perhaps, to don them when you're working from home. It turns out they don't just cost a pretty penny. They're also pretty expensive to sell. That's because luxury watchmakers rely on bricks-and-mortar stores to create an exclusive experience for customers. That means fewer than 10% of those timepieces are actually sold online. Or at least, they were before the pandemic. Today, makers are trying to up their online game in Geneva, Switzerland, where a virtual fair looks to drum up interest for big brands, including Hermès. Here's the company's managing director, Guillaume Desain.
Certainly, it has given a push to online sales, even if watches are not among the luxury products the most easy to sell through online. But it has been growing, definitely. And also, we can say that 2020 have seen the acceleration of some existing trends, specifically the weight of the Asian markets for watch business.
That's Guillaume Desain from Hermès there. Well, if watches aren't your thing, how about chocolate? It turns out that's a buying trend people here in Britain can definitely get behind. We spent more than $600 million on confectionaries ahead of Easter this year. That's according to data from industry group Nielsen. And it's about a 34% jump from last year. And if you ask me, a whole lot of chocolate Easter bunnies. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.